Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and creator of PeopleStack Academy. My guest for this episode is Carly Myers, founder of APOP Studios. Welcome, Carly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. So why don't we get going and tell us a little bit about what you do at APOP?
Okay, so APOP is really focused on the creative, the hustler, and helping them, you know, build their career while also living a happy and healthy lifestyle. So I do creative arts career coaching alongside kind of happiness coaching and workshops and classes, as well as some, you know, digital download tools that can help people along their kind of creative hustle journey.
That's great. So say a little bit about what you mean by creative hustler.
So when I talk about a creative hustler, I'm really talking about, you know, an artist that's trying to get their career off the ground, or someone who's really in a design realm in the sense that they're making handmade products and selling things on platforms like Etsy. So when I say creative hustler, I'm really talking about someone who really lives a creative lifestyle and makes their living that way.
Great. And so what are you working on right now? What's your current project that really has you excited and working hard?
Well, I just launched the Happiness Tracking Journal about a month or so ago. So I'm really, really excited about that. I have some actual physical ones that I'm selling, as well as the digital download ones, which are fully customizable. So I'm really excited about that because it streamlines everyone's daily journaling. So it doesn't seem like this daunting daily task to, you know, write about your day and how it went. And get to know yourself in the process.
Great. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about that. How do you track happiness?
So in our happiness tracking journal, we track it through about 5 different categories. So the first thing that you would track is the happiness rating for the day. And that's just a scale of 1 to 10. So if you're ecstatic and like jumping up and down and like you just got a promotion and, or, you know, things like that, you're going to put a 10. And if you're not really feeling it, you're going to put something in the lower numbers. And then in conjunction with that, we track minutes of exercise, sleep, meditation, moving meditation. And when I say moving meditation, I mean things like art making, yoga, knitting, like some repetitive tasks that you can use as a focus to get back to the present moment. So that's kind of what we track in conjunction with our overall happiness rating, so we can figure out what influences our moods on a daily basis.
Great. So right now it is you said you're selling this. So what, if somebody were to purchase it, what physically do they get? Is it like a PDF or something like that with instructions? So what would somebody get when they're purchasing it?
Right. So if you purchase our digital version, it actually comes in an Excel format. So it's fully customizable. Hmm. And it does come with instructions on how to figure out actually how to grab the data from what you're putting in daily and how to analyze it. Hmm. So you'll get kind of like a one pager on how to really utilize the journal to the best of, you know, your ability. And then you'll get the actual content journal itself, where you're to fill in, you know, the information on a daily basis we encourage like every, you know, 3 to 6 months to a year, you know, analyzing the data that you've accumulated to figure out, you know, how to change the trajectory of your lifestyle. Cool. So that you can live a happier, healthier life.
Cool. I do want to geek out about the data end of this, but before I forget, just in case people want to check this out, what's the best place to go to your website?
Yeah. You can either go to APOP Studios, so APOPstudios.com, or the apopshop.etsy.com.
Awesome. So let's say I were to download this, I have the Excel sheet. Is it a matter of basically entering the numbers, like what's my overall happiness rating today? How many minutes of exercise, how many hours of sleep, how many minutes did I meditate, both sitting and moving? And then I just kind of enter those numbers every day. And then there's instructions on basically how to analyze and interpret that data.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And then we also have, you know, because we all do sometimes enjoy the traditional portion of journaling, you know, we do have the notes section where we can write about our day, but that's not exactly where we'll, you know, analyze the data from.
Cool, cool. So, what kind of analysis is required? Are we talking like means and standard deviations, or are we talking more just like percentage of days that you rated yourself a 10 versus a 1?
We're talking more on means, averages. And then, I mean, we also, if you want to delve into it, we also do, you know, percentages of how many, on average, how much happier am I when I perform a moving meditation? Or, yeah. So, I mean, so that when it comes to making a decision, an important life decision, you actually have data that says, you know what? Art making is really important to my happiness. I am 13% happier whenever I make art. So I'm not going to take on a second job that replaces X, Y, and Z that makes me happier if, you know, I have this data tracking it.
Got it. So is there, let's say over the course of 7 days, my average overall happiness rating was like a 7.5. Is there, do you have like normative data to have like what on average do people rate themselves? So is it about comparing ourselves to other people? Or actually what I hear you saying is it's more about comparing it to yourself on other days when you're doing X behavior versus Y behavior.
Yeah, it's always about comparing it to yourself because we all view this rating system and numbers a little bit differently, and we view our happiness differently. So I think it would be unfair to compare ourselves and our numbers to other people. But it's really about comparing yourself, you know, your past, present, and future self, and kind of making sure you're on the right path.
That's great. So, what have you learned from hearing people who have used this? So, what kind of feedback are you getting from the people who are using the happiness tracking journal? Or is it too early to say yet?
I think it's a little bit too early to say. I've received a little bit of feedback from, you know, the people that have used the happiness tracking journal, and it's really been, you know, I can now tell my spouse or my partner, you know, what I'm feeling, why I'm feeling it. You know, it's not that I'm upset with the external world. It's actually because I didn't get enough sleep or I didn't exercise. And I think just having an awareness, just like when you track your food when you're trying to lose weight, having an awareness of your daily mood really influences how you look at things and how you communicate about yourself and your emotions and mindset.
Yeah, I can absolutely relate to that. I don't track my happiness and all these other things in such a in the same way that you're having folks do this, but I have started meditating every day for the past month or so, and like that alone has, as you're talking about awareness, so that alone has given me the awareness to know, like for example, when I'm talking to my husband and I start to get a little bit irritated, right? It's I'm not irritated at you. I'm not, whereas before I might turn it into, when you go down this rabbit hole of like, oh, you said this thing that made me upset and then you did this other thing, and right, but becoming more aware of, you know what, where this all started was because I'm feeling, I don't know, guilty that I didn't go to yoga yesterday. And that may be like, that may have been the domino effect. And so I think that helps. It helps myself. It helps a relationship. So I could see how tracking all of these things, like not just when you're meditating or when you're doing exercise, but also like how much sleep you get. And so exercise, sleep, meditation, moving meditation, and then overall rating. So those are the things that are involved in the tracking.
And
Cool.
what's great about, you know, what we have with our digital download is that if there's something in your life that you're already aware that makes you happier, but you don't really have the data that you would like to, you know, back your decision making. I know a lot of artists always come to me whenever we do career coaching. They feel guilty that they're taking time away from their family or away from their job that's bringing in income to make their artwork or to make their design work that, you know, really fuels their souls and their passion in life for life. And adding those, you know, extra categories just to get rid of that guilt. You know, we shouldn't feel guilty for doing the things that make us happy. has been really nice.
Yeah, that's really powerful that like I decided to do this to make myself happy. Great. And so if mm-hmm. I didn't do it, I shouldn't feel guilty about it. It should just be, okay, I didn't do it today. Does it mean I'm not going to be as happy? I don't know. Maybe it will, maybe it won't, but it is what it is. I think it gets a little bit trickier though when you're talking about things like exercise, because I think we all know, like for example, with exercise or eating well, like for example, that guilt kind of takes on a different tone. It has a different feeling, like you know, versus like if you were to compare something like, okay, like say someone were to do yoga, not necessarily for like for exercise, but just because they like the feeling and it makes them happy and they like the mini meditation involved in that, versus someone who goes to the gym every week because it keeps their cholesterol numbers down and they're losing weight. I think not going to yoga in that place, in that situation versus not going to the gym, there's kind of a different kind of guilt that's associated with that, because you know that not going to the gym is going to affect other health related things that the yoga may not.
Right.
So it, I think it gets a little bit trickier that way. But I think just tracking it, being aware of it, like you're saying, can really help us become aware of those different flavors of guilt, as I'm trying to explain, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of the key things is that we're tracking, you know, exercise in conjunction with meditation and moving meditation so that we're not, so we realize that both our physical health and our mental health are really important. And they're equally important, but meditation is something that, you know, keeps us from, it kind of makes us aware and also kind of deters us from having guilt, or helps us deter ourselves from that guilt and from the certain feelings after a certain amount of practice and time put in. So I think, you know, having the correlation between mind and body is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's turn this a little bit toward the tech end of the conversation. So as we're kind of talking about the intersection of kind of the creative worlds and the art worlds and the tech world, let's dig a little bit deeper there. Like what lies at the intersection of the art world and the tech world? When you think about that intersection, what's there? Is it conflict? Is it awesomeness? Is it something else?
Oh my goodness. It's a ton of opportunity.
And
there's definitely conflict. I mean, I come from a printmaking background in the art world. So I know there's a lot of conflict with technology moving to, you know, moving away from the handmade and doing everything in Photoshop or in the computer and kind of exporting it out of there. So there's a lot of conflict between the, you know, new agers and you know, traditional art, traditional artists. So there's definitely that. But there's also, yeah, this awesomeness, because we have so many artists using technology, you know, to push so many, you know, to push things forward into a realm that we've never experienced in the art world. I know that, I think we do First Fridays in Philadelphia where all the galleries open up and show kind of what the art scene is doing right now. What are artists doing? And I went to a show last month in the Vox building here in Philly, and I got to experience an interactive exhibit where I was holding up a tablet and looking through it, and the whole room was virtual reality. I was basically like pointing this tablet at works of art, and it was reading the art as basically a complicated QR code, and it was transforming what I saw on my screen into this crazy, intricate, beautiful, scary sometimes world. So I think that's something that's really exciting, really awesome, and is engaging communities in different ways that we would have never expected 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, and that's the power of collaboration. When people don't say, you know, like from people from the art world, just turn away from the tech world or vice versa, that kind of stuff is impossible. Go ahead. Were you going to say something?
Oh, go ahead.
I had another question. I was going to follow up a little bit on what you were saying earlier about this sort of conflict between the handmade versus the, I guess we might call it the digitized, the photoshopped of the world. So have you personally experienced or know of, say, folks in the art world who have their feet firmly planted only in the sort of traditional handmade world and for whatever reason will not, don't want to try to move into more of the digital world?
Yeah, there's a lot of people on both ends of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. There's this community of artists that will not, absolutely will not use technology as part of their artistic practice. And it's because of this idea that technology is the assistant for, you know, a human. Technology is something that makes things easier. It's kind of like, quote unquote, cheating in a way if you use technology to create your artwork. I know artists that are very traditional and they'll take ink out of toner out of printers to make their ink, but they will not use the printer to print their, you know, their work of art.
Uh-huh.
So it's interesting,
right,
that they'll take the materials out of the technology.
Right. So that's interesting that using tech is cheating as an artist, that sort of concept that may lie at the heart of what, where some of the conflict and resistance, or maybe even not that strong of a term, just a sort of, you know, big question mark there, you know, just a sort of sense of, I'm an artist and this is what I do. I don't want to cheat. So what would you say in response to someone who said, oh, I can't, an artist who said, oh, I can't do that. I don't want to do that. That's cheating.
Okay. So I would probably say something along the lines of, do you text? Do you make phone calls on your cell phone? Then you might be cheating at life because you might have to walk about 50 miles to have that conversation.
Yeah.
It's really, you know, you're not cheating by using your phone to send a text message or make a phone call. So it's just something that is improving your life and, you know, bettering your artistic practice. When you're using it as a tool, it's something that can be, you know, used as a tool, just like a pencil, just like a paintbrush, just like, you know, an X-Acto knife or whatever you will.
Uh-huh.
It's a tool to be manipulated and to be learned so that we can create the next generation of, you know, inspiring and forward-thinking art.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And I'm trying to think of sort of the other end of it. So if you have a tech person who might be resistant to the art world, I would say, and then this is just based on my experience, that perhaps some of the resistance, whether people are aware of it or not, might be like, so if you think of a tech person, like a software engineer or something like that, who says, or who thinks, you know, if you just go to the extreme, oh, art has no place in the tech world. Although it may not always be that extreme, it may be much more subtle than that. But just for the sake of example, I think it's easier to think that way, that they may be thinking that perhaps because they think of the art world as not like as systematized enough, as creating art is way too, you know, it's way too sporadic, it's way too chaotic. There's no system to it versus, you know, in the tech world, it's all about systems and it's all about testing and retrying and trying again, you know, just like we were talking about earlier, the app's not going to work the first time. You need to go through several iterations. And so same question, where we're just flipping it around. What would you say to a tech person who says that art has no place in tech because art is not systematized enough?
I would say, take a look around. There's not an app in the app store that wasn't designed based on artistic principles. There's not a sign around the city, around, you know, your community that isn't designed on the same artistic principles. It's intertwined with technology on so many levels that they can't be separated. Because I know so many artists that have taken their careers into a design realm where they take their traditional knowledge and apply it to you know, whatever the latest thing is, whether it's an app, whether it's designing the interface of Twitter or the interface of Facebook, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's so intertwined, design and tech and art. Design is basically, you know, the bouncing off point, it's a jumping off point from art. So that's kind of what I would say.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on this intersection or the conflict or some of the awesome stuff that lies at the intersection of art and tech?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot to be said on the awesomeness side of things. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's just these so many opportunities that I can't even verbalize because I don't even know what they are, what they're going to be. I think that's what's so exciting is we have no idea how the collaboration of art and tech is going to be, you know, in 5 years versus now. I mean, I think I think tech really has taken, at least from my perspective in the art world, has really been a support primarily for performance artists. And I think that's really exciting. I know I'm failing to remember the artist's name. She's a pretty popular artist, but she, you know, used tech and audio guides to create a user experience outside of the museum, outside of the gallery, where she takes, you know, each participant, each viewer around their cities, around Philly, around Boston, all around, and giving a different perspective on, you know, what to think when we're looking around our communities. That's not traditional use of art and tech. It's a collaboration that performance seems to be something that's really, really latching on. Performance artists are really latching on to tech as a tool to engage audiences.
Yeah, that's great.
And it could be, now I'm thinking about this just now, it could be that there's this also conflict or fear that tech is taking over in a sense that we can't have people aren't going to a museum and fully engaging with, you know, paintings and drawings and sculptures anymore without looking at their phone or seeing the artwork through the lens of a camera. So I think many artists are starting to think, how can I engage the technology to engage viewers and audiences in a more genuine way? Because that's how we kind of communicate and live our lives now.
Yeah, I think, and that kind of reminds me, it's a little bit of a tangent, but it kind of reminds me of the whole, the augmented reality thing that's going on right now, you know, with lots of different forms of augmented reality out there, games and things like that. And I do hear from time to time the resistance to augmented reality, that why don't you live in the real world? Why do you want to live in an augmented world? But I actually have a very personal experience with augmented reality. It may be a bit of a stretch, but the way that I look at it is I wear hearing aids. And I would not be able to hear the world as crisply and as cleanly if I didn't wear the hearing aids. And they're a kind of technology that are providing me with an augmented reality. Sure, it's but it's a heightened sort of experience of the world. And so then, like when the Google Glasses came out, for example, there was a little bit of resistance to that. Like, oh, why would I want to look through glasses? And why would I want to have all this stuff in front of me or whatever it was? I never used them, but I had some friends who did. And I was like, and just like your example with the cell phone, right? You use a cell phone, it helps us to live our lives better. So yeah, I love the example of the performance art. That's definitely something to keep an eye out for.
Yeah.
So I want to sort of start wrapping this up a little bit, but not quite yet. I want to go back to this idea of the creative hustler and sort of circle back to that. And because it's the creative hustlers who you primarily market to, correct?
Right, right.
And so it's those folks who you're saying, here, use this happiness tracking journal, for example. Why do you think they, in particular, the creative hustlers, need to, let's say, track their happiness?
I think that it's, you know, it's not just the creative hustlers. It is really a more general idea that we need to balance our work life. You know, it needs to be a work life balance. And my viewpoint on that is actually it's all the same. It's all the same. Work and life are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly for this group of people, you know, that I work so closely with, it's always, we're always sacrificing, and I feel like I'm part of this group. So we're always sacrificing, you know, our happiness, our sleep, our exercise, et cetera, to finish the latest work of art, to finish the latest piece, to get something in front of people. And I think taking a step back, from that kind of portion of the creative hustlers and taking a step back and realizing, you know what, like artists don't have to always be crazy and angry and et cetera, we don't have to fit under that stereotype. But then we also have on the other side of that kind of people that who are artists that feel not making their art makes them feel a certain way. And so that group of people that aren't hustling as hard as they should be, because they're afraid of, you know, the consequences mm-hmm. in their family life or work life. Mm-hmm. So really it's to find a balance between the two, you know, between the person that is so used to the art school, kind of lifestyle where you stay up till 6 a.m. finishing a project that's due, you know, by X time. And then, you know, the person that started a family and now feels guilty for creating art because that's time that could be this, or they took a second job, you know, mm-hmm. to really balance. If you are an artist, if you're a designer, a creative, that really is what feeds your soul. So let's really think about balance between that and life and, you know, everything in between.
Yeah. Yeah. What role do you think money plays in this conflict and balance that you're referring to? And I'm asking this question because I have experience through various professional development sort of seminars and things that I've gone through, and folks experiences with folks in the art world who are starting their own businesses, who there seems to be, and this isn't exclusive to the art world, although it tends to be pretty common from my experience of it, that there's this sort of negative mindset around money for the art world that doesn't tend to be there as much in the tech world. You know, tech companies love talking about how much money they're making, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. not necessarily a bad thing. I think that can actually be a good thing. It's being transparent about how much we're making, how much we're losing, what's working, what's not. You know, I think it's just part of sort of the tech world, this transparency. But my experience anyway with the art world is that folks, they have sort of this discomfort around money, and more to the point, don't feel like they can charge what they really want to charge, and sometimes don't charge enough. Do you have a similar experience around that? Comments on that?
Oh my goodness, I've been nodding my head like time.
Yeah. If we were watching video, yeah, that's the good thing about video, right? Okay, good.
Yeah, it's one of the first things that I talk to my clients about whenever I meet with them is, you know, digging down into what their relationship with money is and why they feel that way. And most of the time it's because society has built in this idea that artists are poor. I know I've culturally felt, you know, since I started making a little bit more, or not having $4 in my bank account, we'll say, you know, that you are, when you're in this artistic community, it's kind of quote unquote cool mm-hmm. to cry poor, to say, oh my goodness, I can't afford eggs this week. Like, what am I going to do? Like, that is the norm. And that's, you know, it makes everybody feel related and in a community and in it together. But that's one of the things that I'm trying to work with people to, you know, change, because money is really not the, you know, the root of all evil. It's the thing that provides for our family, lets us eat, lets us, you know, go on a cool vacation. It lets us live a good life. So changing our perception with money as an artist is really important. one of the tools that I suggest to a lot of my clients is this time tracking tool called Toggle. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Yeah. What is it again? So,
Toggle, T-O-G-G-L.
Okay.
And it's just a time management tool. And so basically I'll say, you know, what is your hourly rate? And here's this app, and you should really use it to track how much time you're spending on each individual piece that you're making. Mm. And so that there's no guesswork at the end of the day. You know, you spent 45 hours making this work of art. Well, okay, so now we're going to multiply it by your hourly rate plus materials, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There's no guess game like, oh, I don't know how much time I spent on this piece. It's big, but I don't know. Maybe it'll be worth 120.
Yeah.
Like there's no room for, you know, underselling yourself and selling yourself short.
Right.
So I think that also this idea that we're tracking our time as artists with tech, helps us realize that our time is valuable. Like as we see that tick, you know, that tick tock, the clock on your phone, going by, when you're creating artwork, you realize that, yeah, this is time in my life that I'm spending, you know, creating something, for the world. So,
yeah. And I think that I would go even a step further as far as the way that the artists might want to think about pricing is that, yeah, it's absolutely about the amount of time that I put into it, but it's also about exactly what you just said. What is this awesome thing that I just created for the world? What is this beautiful thing, this disruptive thing that I just created for the world? What value does the world, that does that add to the world? And that, mm-hmm. So I think that tracking time is definitely a good part of it and a good, a necessary piece of it, so that at least you are getting back what you put into it. But mm-hmm. I think that by shifting it even a little bit more to say, okay, this is how much it cost me in terms of time and materials and everything else, but that, you know, just to sort of and have that number in the back of your head, but then just sort of forget about that for a second and say, what value is this bringing to the world? You know, it's a piece of art. You know, you can mm-hmm. have this same piece of art, you know, and this happens like when we go, like when you go to, like restaurants, and you know, every once in a while you'll see art hanging on the walls and stuff like that. It always mm-hmm. does baffle me sometimes when I'll look at the art hanging on the wall and, you know, it might say like $120 or something like that. I'm like, okay, right. But I'm thinking in the back of my mind, like I would actually pay a little bit more for that because I've seen similar paintings or things like that hanging in other restaurants or in other public venues with a $300 price tag or $750 price tag. And it's just very interesting. And tricky to value it, but it's just another way of thinking about it. What's the outcome? What am I giving to the world? It's not just about what I put into it.
Yeah, exactly. Another thing that I would say is that I work with a lot of people that, you know, work, they have jobs outside of their own artistic practice. And I always like to pose the question, how much money would you pay your boss or your coworkers so that you could make art for an hour for a few hours? How much would you pay them to be able to do what you love to do? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes you'd realize that you pay a lot more than you think. Cause you're charging, perhaps you're charging $10 an hour for a piece, but you think about it and you'd actually pay your boss $40 an hour just so that you could spend some time in the studio.
Yeah.
And that really clarifies a lot of things for a lot of the people that I work with, because they realize that, oh yeah, if I'm not spending time making my art, I'm doing something else.
That's right.
And balancing those two things and thinking about what's most important to your happiness and to your artistic career. If you want to leave whatever field you're in to be a full-time professional artist.
Yep. Yeah. It all comes back to balance, right? I love that. Mm-hmm. So one final question for you that I ask virtually all of my podcast guests. So what is your biggest people-related challenge in running APOB Studios? And you can interpret that any way that you like. So what's your biggest people-related challenge in running APOB?
Well, I think we really touched on it. I actually have written down money/fear.
Okay.
it's this this outlook on money and life. But I think that it also is this skepticism, this cynicism that, or lack of confidence that each person isn't a good enough artist to, you know, be able to make a living doing this, or good enough designer to charge what they need to be charging so that they can live the life that they ultimately want to live. This fear that money, getting money, charging for money somehow makes you ingenuine as a person, as an artist. So I think that's been, you know, my biggest people-related challenge is saying, you know, this is possible. Here's the steps to get there. You know, let's talk this through. You know, what is your mindset? How is your mindset holding you back from living a happy life, from living your craziest pie in the sky dreams the whole way through, and to the best of your abilities? So I think that's been a challenge, but I'm learning every day from each, you know, each new interaction, yeah. Each new experience.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's almost, and I experienced the same thing. I was, my background is psychology, and my training is in psychology. And I always said, you know, I don't want to become a shrink. You know, I don't want to be a counselor or a therapist, because I just, that's not something that I want to do every single day of my life. And it's still not something that I want to do every single day and focus 100% of my time on. But as I'm doing more work and having more interactions within the tech world, and particularly within the tech leadership world, exactly what you just described, the same thing exists. It's for slightly different reasons, and it's obviously a different context, but sort of this fear, this skepticism, this cynicism, like, oh, I'm not really a good leader, and I could never be a good leader, and, you know, I could never command a salary like that, you know, or they look at people like Elon Musk and say, I'd love to be able to do that, but not me. And so the first thing, you know, it's mindset stuff. It's sort of, okay, if you want this, let's figure out what you need to do in order to get there. You know, it's almost like it's coaching, right? You know, in the same way that, like, when you go to the gym, your coach tells you, yes, you can do one more rep, right? It's like, yes, you can. Exactly. It's almost like hearing the permission from someone, like, yes, you can do that. I don't care how many other people tell you that you can't. And I have evidence that people can. So it is really interesting, you know, just sort of getting back to sort of the intersection between tech and art, that there are so many similarities between the worlds, and lots of other worlds too, that we want to think that sometimes we think that it's so different, but at the heart of it, we're all going through very similar kinds of struggles.
Mm-hmm.
Great. So any final comments, questions that you wanted to talk about before we wrap it up for the day?
You know, I think that is everything. It's really been a pleasure.
it's been a great conversation, Carly. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that wraps up another episode of the PeopleStack podcast. Check out my website, jenbunk.com. That's JenBunk.com, where you can find lots of goodies, including a link to PeopleStack Academy, my online school dedicated to helping the tech community build better people processes. Also on jenbunk.com, you can sign up for the Changelog, the PeopleStack weekly email with tips and exclusive offers only available to my email tribe. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.